This class in Sefer Bereshit, and it is Wednesday morning, November 19th, here at the JCC, and we are going to, for better or for worse, put aside the curriculum today, and look at a part of Sefer Bereshit that the curriculum skips. The curriculum skips the selection of Avraham Avinu, the beginning of what's called Parshat Lech Lecha, the third Parsha of the Torah, after Bereshit and after Noah comes Lech Lecha, which is God's announcement of the selection of Avraham to found a new nation. And I suppose that the reason, or one of the reasons why the curriculum skips this seminal matter in the formation of Jewish nation, is because some emphasis was given to it in the earlier 2 years of the Melton program. That's what my assumption is. But I would like to look at and focus on an aspect of the selection of Avraham, which I'm sure was not focused on at all in the first 2 years of Milton, and it's something probably that most people have never given any thought to, so I hope we'll discover something interesting, exciting, relevant, and meaningful. Here we go. We begin with chapter 12, verses 1 to 6. Chapter 12, verses 1 to 6 is where we will begin. We will then go backwards to earlier verses. So we're reading in our translation of the Torah, Sefer Bereshit, chapter 12, verses 1 to 6. The Lord said to Avram, "Go forth from your native land and from your father's house to the land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation. And I will bless you. And I will make your name great. And you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and curse him that curses you. And all the families of the earth shall bless themselves by you, or be blessed through you." Avram went forth as the Lord had commanded him, and Lot went with him. Avram was 75 years old when he left Haran. Avram took his wife Sarai, and his brother's son Lot, and all the wealth that they had amassed, and the persons that they had acquired in Haran, and they set out for the land of Canaan. When they arrived in the land of Canaan, Avram passed through the land as far as the site of Shechem, today's city of Nablus, at the terebinth of Moreh. The Canaanites were then in the land. That's enough to begin reading with. Famous verses. God suddenly tells Avram, it seems with no background, no reason, no rhyme or reason, leave your native land, put everything else aside, forget your past, I'll make of you a new nation in this new land. Now, an obvious question that everyone asks, every student asks, every midrash asks, every commentator asks is, why did God choose Abraham? What was different about him? What was special about him? What was unique about him? What did he do to deserve this? How do we know? How does God know he's going to be able to be the founder of this great and mighty and important nation? That question, why did God choose Abraham, has given birth. The question has given birth to a slew of commentators and commentaries and midrashim. Some of them very ancient, some of them modern. And I'm certain that many of the people in this room know some of the answers that the ancient rabbis gave to the question of why God chose Abraham. The midrash tells a story, and again, the story is an answer to our question. The story of Avraham, whose father Terach was an idol maker, an idolater and idol maker, and he sold the idols in the store. And many of us have heard the story in Hebrew school or in other frameworks, that one day Terach had to go to the doctor or someplace else and he couldn't mind the store. He gave the keys to his young son Avraham. He said, "You mind the store, take care of it for me, sell idols to those who come in." What happened? Avram gets into the store, And he decides to do something rather radical. He destroys all the idols. He takes a hammer and he breaks them all down. Stone, wood, whatever they were made of, he destroys them. He leaves one standing, the biggest one, the strongest one, the tallest one, and he puts the hammer in the hand of that idol. His father comes back, "Ay, gevolt, my livelihood is gone. What are we going to do, Avram? What happened?" And says Avram, "I can't tell a lie. I have to tell you the truth. A fight broke out among the idols. They were fighting perhaps over the porridge over there. They were fighting over this female idol. I don't know what was happening. But it was terrible to see. And this one idol, this bully, look how big he is." He...
Oh, this is the punchline of the story.
I can't tell a lie. Look, that this big idol here, it has the hatchet in its hand. It killed all the others. It destroyed them. It won the battle, won the fight, and it got the food. His father looks at him, "Are you crazy? They are only wood and stone. They can't fight. They don't have any minds." Says Avram to his father, "Listen to the words that your mouth speaks." The Torah doesn't say that. That's the rabbinic answer to the question, why did God choose Avram? And the answer that's behind the story is, Avram was an iconoclastic thinker. He had a head on his shoulders. He was willing to think independently, to go against the grain, to rebel against the society, the culture, his family, and even to rebel against his father. And being that he's an independent thinker, he's willing to do what he knows to be true and certain, he is fitting to lead the Jewish people. That's the answer the Midrash gives. And there are many other answers that Midrashim give that are similar to this, pointing at Avram as a thinker, an explorer, a philosopher. He worshipped the sun, it didn't work. He worshipped the moon, he tried different possibilities, and he came to the conclusion that these idols aren't true, there's only one God. I want to put all of that aside. I didn't say forget it, but put it aside. The question that we want to ask ourselves, and it's a question we often ask ourselves, what does the text say? What does the text of the Torah say? Does the Torah have anything to say about that question, why did God choose Abraham? So we're going to, for a moment, circumvent the Midrash, the Midrash that all children are taught, and we all, or many of us know, and see if the Torah itself can give us an answer to the question. So, there's a problem here. There's a problem over there also, I see.
But Rabbi, if everybody got their thing from Belton this morning, you would have had the answer.
What? You already looked at Belton this morning as well.
I opened up my email very early. From Belton in Jerusalem, they sent out the answer.
Okay, I don't know.
I'm
looking right now. I don't think I got the answer. I'm not on the right email.
Okay, so I think that one of the reasons that we don't often look in the text, the Torah text, for an answer to the question of why God chose Abraham is because the verses in which God chooses Abraham are the beginning of a new parsha, Parshat Lech Lecha. We forgot that we read last week. We read a previous parsha last week in synagogue. I mean, when we read Lech Lecha, the week before we read Noah. We just have to turn back a few verses, turn back a whole week, and see that there might be the beginnings of an answer to our question in the text of the Torah itself. So we turn back to the previous verses, and the roadmap tells you that we just did chapter 12, verse 1 to 6, the sheets that I gave out. And then we're going back to chapter 11, verses 31 to 32. Does anyone need sheets? So come and take a few here or pass them down for those who didn't receive. Okay. Elaine needs. I'll just put over here. So we turn back to chapter 11, verse 31 to 32. And we discover something, I think, that's amazing. Unbelievable. Mind-boggling. And people just don't notice this. Terach took his son Avram, his grandson Lot, the son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, the wife of his son Avram, and they set out together from Ur of the Chaldeans for the land of Canaan. But when they had come as far as Haran, they settled there. The days of Terach came to 205 years, and Terach died in Haran. That's amazing. We just read that God's call to Abraham to leave his land and go to the promised land was not an original act. It wasn't something that had no foundation. Rather, Terach himself had begun that journey. And God is only telling Abraham, continue the journey that your father began. That shows things in a whole different light. Whole different light. Right? It's a continuation of an old beginning, and it's not a new divine initiative. It's the continuation of a human initiative of Terach, it appears. Terach decided, we still have to understand why and how, Terach decided to go on a journey from his motherland to the land of Canaan, and God says to Abraham, continue the journey that your father began. Whereas we might have thought that Abraham turns over a complete new leaf. No, if anyone turns over a new leaf, it's Terach. And Abraham is simply following in the footsteps of his father at the behest of God. A whole different perspective, and now we can begin trying to make some sense of this perspective. Yeah. So father began a journey. He meant to go, the verse says very clearly in verse 31, that he meant to go to the land of Canaan. For some reason he got bogged down on the way. We'll have to ask ourselves why, what happened? And then God says, continue where your father left off. Go to the same place that your father meant to. He only made it halfway. You make it on to the destination. Now, I hope you're scandalized. Right. It's important. It's really important. It's going to give us a whole new perspective on many different things.
But Terach went on his own. Nobody told. God didn't tell Terach. Terach went for economic reasons.
I don't know why he went, but isn't that wonderful?
We don't know.
We don't know yet. Terach, now it's apparently something good to go to the land of Canaan. God commanded it later. Terach did it on his own. Mm-hmm. Avram only did it when commanded. That shows Terach, I would think, in a very, very fine light. But we'll get to that.
It raises the question of what is meant in verse 12 by Me'artzecha u'mimolatzecha.
Yes.
Because what does it mean to leave your native land, the place where you were born, when you've already begun that journey?
Right. Right.
You've already left there.
Right. There are tens of commentators upon that. Mm-hmm. We're not going to deal with that. It's important. But it's not directly, I think it doesn't directly impinge upon the points that I want to make. But you're right. It's an important question. But anyway, what I want to say now is that what we just discovered, something tremendously important, is certainly not something the Torah meant to hide. It's black and white. Just have to read the verses, read the context, and see that it's there. Not only didn't the Torah mean to hide it, it actually used, the Torah used certainly certain literary devices to point out what we just saw. And I want to show you those literary devices. It's a little harder in English than in Hebrew. The translation always obscures to a certain degree the little textual nuances that are so important to point out connections and context, but we can try. Let's compare chapter 11, verse 31. Chapter 11, verse 31. Compare that with chapter 12, verse 5. Mm-hmm. I'm going to read those two verses one after the other. First, 31, 5. And the sheets I gave you are going to help us with the comparison. They give us, the sheets give you the three points we're going to make. So you can look at the sheet in front of you. I'm going to read both of those verses. First, 11:31. Terach took his son Avram, his grandson Lot, the son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, the wife of his son Avram, and they set out together from Ur of the Chaldeans for the land of Canaan, but when they had come as far as Haran, they settled there. And comparing that to chapter 12, verse 5, Avram took his wife Sarai, and his brother's son Lot, and all the wealth that they had amassed, and the persons that they acquired in Haran, and they set out for the land of Canaan when they arrived in the land of Canaan, period. These two verses are parallel, extremely parallel. Mm-hmm. And my sheet showed you the 3 points of contact between them. Number one, both of these verses begin with the proper name of someone. The subject of the sentence is at the beginning of the sentence, and it's a proper name. In the first case, it's Terach. In the second case, it's Avram. Mm-hmm. And that's number one. Number two, in both cases, the subject is followed by a verb, and it's the same verb in both sentences. The verb is took, in both cases. Thirdly, in both cases, this subject took X, Y, and Z. X, Y, and Z. If you look in chapter 11, verse 31, Terach took Avram, number one, his grandson Lot, number two, and his daughter-in-law Sarai. Three things. In chapter 12, verse 5, it's also three things and actually one more. But it's three things that they took. Terach took first of all, I'm sorry, Avram took his wife Sarai, that's number one, his brother-in-law Lot, and all the wealth they'd established, and the persons. So it's four things, three persons, three persons. Just like in chapter 11, verse 31, it was three persons that were taken, Avram, Lot, and Sarai. So we have a subject, a proper name, who then the verb took, and then three persons that are taken. Furthermore, in both cases, it says, and they set out for the land of Canaan. Word for word. And they set out for the land of Canaan. In chapter 11, verse 31, it says, and they set out together from the Kasim for the land of Canaan. I just take a few words out, and it's they set out for the land of Canaan. Those exact words in English and in Hebrew are found in chapter 12, verse 5. And they set out for the land of Canaan. So the parallel is quite striking. Furthermore, we now find that the verse goes on and says in both cases, and they came. This is hard to find in the English because the English obscures it. But look at chapter 11, verse 31. Our English translation says, but when they had come as far as Haran. In the Hebrew, and they came to Haran. And they came. In the chapter 12, it's the exact same words. I'm sorry that it's translated differently. And they came. Our English translation says, when they arrived in the land of Canaan. But the Hebrew says, and they came. Of course, in chapter 11, they came to Haran. In chapter 12, they came to Canaan. Which just goes to show you that chapter 12, what Avram does in chapter 12, is a continuation, word for word, of what his father did. The same words are used, right? The same structure. Here in chapter 11, it's Terach doing it. Here in chapter 12, it's Avram doing it. They're both doing the same activities, except that Terach got only to halfway on his journey. His intention was to go further, but he got halfway. Avram went the full mile. Now, there's even more to it. The verse actually emphasizes a further point. Look in chapter 12, verse 5. The second half of the verse. Chapter 12, verse 5. And they set out for the land of Canaan. We said that's word for word from the previous chapter. And they set out for the land of Canaan. And then the next words. Look at the next words. When they arrived in the land of Canaan, comma, verse 6 begins, Avram passed through the land as far as the site of Shechem. The English translation is problematic. The English translation takes the end of verse 5 and tacks it onto verse 6. Do you see that?
Right.
Why does it do that? Because it has a problem. There's a problem in the Hebrew text. And the English tries to solve it. But by trying to solve the problem, it obscures something that we have to point out right now. What the Hebrew really says is the following. I'm going to read verse 5 to you in English, but in my translation. Verse 5. Avram took his wife Sarai, and his brother's son Lot, and all the wealth that they had amassed, and the persons they had acquired in Haran, and they set out for the land of Canaan. And they arrived in the land of Canaan. It just says, and they arrived. It doesn't say when. It says, and they arrived in the land of Canaan, period. The English translation didn't like that because it's superfluous. It says, They set out to land in Canaan, and they arrived in Canaan. Why did you say both things? If they arrived there, why did you say they set out? Of course, if they arrived there, they set out. And therefore, it tried to take apart this sentence, verse 5, and put the end of the verse into the next verse to take away this superfluity.
But
I want to point out why the Hebrew is indeed phrased as it is. The Hebrew says, and they set out for Canaan, and they reached Canaan. We don't usually talk like that, but why does it talk like that? In order to make the contrast. Yes. I'm sorry that I...
No, that's fine. Go ahead.
The contrast with chapter 30, 11, verse 11, okay. Where it said there in chapter 11, verse 31, it said, and they set out to the land of Canaan, but when they came as far as Canaan, they settled there. In other words, chapter 11 says they set out for X and didn't get there. Chapter 12 says they set out for X and they got to X, to point out that this again is a continuation. Abraham's journey is a continuation of his father's journey with the exact same intention, but this time the intention was fulfilled. The Torah therefore uses superfluous words, uses words that are grammatically not usually found together, saying they intended to get to X and they got to X, but it does that in order to make the connection and contrast to the story that began at the end of chapter 11. Again, just to make the point that the Torah is clearly telling us that the proper way to understand the journey of Abraham is as a continuation of his father's journey and not something new, not the turning over of a new leaf, not a new stage in history. If you want to talk about a new stage of history, go back one generation to Terach. It doesn't begin with Abraham. With that behind us, we have to now study not Avraham's journey, but Terach's journey. To understand Avraham's journey, we have to understand Terach's journey, because Avraham's is just a continuation of Terach's. So, if we're now focusing on Terach, in chapter 11, verse 31 and 32, we'll have to learn the context of Terach's journey, which obviously means we have to now go back even further in chapter 11. And that's why the roadmap that I gave to you says, now go back to chapter 11, verses 26 to 30. Chapter 11, verses 26 to 30. Okay? When Terach had lived 70 years, he begat Avram, Nahor, and Haran. Now this is the line of Terach. Terach begat Avram, Nahor, and Haran. And Haran begat Lot. Haran died in the lifetime of his father Terach, in his native land, Ur of the Chaldeans. Avram and Nahor took to themselves wives, the name of Avram's wife being Sarai, and that of Nahor's wife Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah and Yiscah. Now Sarai was barren, she had no child. We'll go back over that. Now, we have to understand verses 26, 27, 28, 9, and 30, word for word. It begins chapter 11, verse 26, when Terach had lived 70 years, he begat.
Had he begotten them before he became 70, or did he first have them at the age of 70?
At the age of 70.
At the age of 70.
And that's a red flag. That's a red flag. Late bloomer.
Well, there's the fertilogenarian.
Who we already know from Avram. I already see, by the way, a connection to Avram and his father. Yeah. Both late bloomers.
Sarah too.
Say it again?
Sarah too.
To make the point clear and stronger, we'll now go backwards even further to the seven previous verses, going back to verse 12. When Arpachshad had lived 35 years, he begot Shelach. I'll skip the next verse. 14. When Shelach lived 30 years, he begot Aver. Next, when Aver had lived 30 years, he begot Peleg. Verse 18. When Peleg had lived 30 years, he begot Reu. Verse 20. When Reu had lived 32 years, he begot Serug. 22. When Serug had lived 30 years, he begot Nahor. Verse 24. When Nahor had lived 29 years, he begot Terach. Verse 26, I lived 70 years. What a difference. 29 years of age, 30, 31, 32, 33. Everyone has kids with the age of 34. And Terach, it takes the age of 40, the age of 50, the age of 60, the age of 70. Something is very, very strange here. Terach is a unique individual in some sense. Now, the question is, what happened? Why did it take him so long? So it could be a problem with Shidduchim. It could be a problem he just didn't find a match. Perhaps that would be significant. Why did it take so long? But another possibility, something we find more often in the Bible, is that people are barren. People are impotent. And it takes a long, long time, if at all, that children are born. So all of the fathers and grandfathers and great-grandfathers and great-great-great-grandfathers of Terach managed to have a simple life in which they got married, had children, beautiful, there's already grandchildren, the generations continue, and Terach got married and nothing happened. And he waits a long, long, long time.
But it's worth the wait.
Perhaps it's worth the wait. Another few minutes, we'll talk about what was going on during that wait, but first I want to cover a few other points. Yeah?
But what about, I know you started at that 11, verse 12, but what about the one before where they're talking about this is a line of Seth, Shem, and they say Shem was 100 years old when he begot Arphaxad.
Right, so Shem was perhaps another one of those unique individuals that something is going on that has to be talked about. We didn't talk about it. But at least for the last seven generations, things have been normal, and Terach is abnormal, just like his great-great-great-great-great-great-great grandfather was in perhaps in that same category.
Okay.
So we'll get back. Yes?
I was wondering if it was because he was in the idol business that he stayed barren.
Because the idols were
saying.
Well, you know what? We don't know he's in the idol business. We don't know he's in the idol business. That's the Midrash that says that. We know he's part of a society, so he probably was an idolater like everyone else, but we can't be certain. Perhaps he was, perhaps he wasn't. But everyone else was also an idolater. So why did he only suffer, not his father and his grandfather and his great-grandfather and his great-great-great-great? So anyway, so the first point is, that has to be highlighted, is that it took a long time for Terach and Mrs. Terach to have children. We'll get back to that. Point number two, that these verses that we just read, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, emphasize, is there was a second difficulty, a second trial and tribulation, a second tragedy in the life of Terah, which is what? He lost his son. Right? You wait 70 years for children to be born. Thank God they had three wonderful children. But then it says in verse 28, Haran died in the lifetime of his father Terach. And I emphasize, in the lifetime. He could have just said that Haran died in the lifetime. To point out to you, I assume that he died young, and it caused a large degree of trauma to the family, to Terach. Now, it's a terrible thing when a child dies young. And by the way, we don't mean to say he was an infant. He had a child when he died. Haran already had Lot, so he was in his 20s at least. But it's still a terrible thing when a child dies in the lifetime of his parents. It's that much more painful when this child was one that the parents were waiting for so many years. At the age of 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, no children. At the age of 70, children are born. And then not too many years later, one of them dies young. That's a terrible tragedy. Point number three, not only did Terach live a life of difficulty in not having children till a late age, not only did one of those children die at a young age, but when Terach's children grew up, one of his three sons finds himself in the same terrible situation that his father was in, and I mean the reference that we have at the very end, verse 20, now Sarai was barren, she had no child, and she is the wife of Avram. So the tragedy is repeating itself. And that's something, as parents, we all know, is extremely painful when you see that you pass on your genetic diseases, or you pass on your own faults, or you pass on your own shortcomings to your children and you see it coming true again. It's terrible. A third tragedy in the lifetime of Terach, his son Avram is impotent, or Sarai is barren, they can't have children, and the family goes through now the same things they went through 20 years ago and 30 years ago and 40 years and 50 years ago. What are we going to do? So, I can't but be certain that if the Torah in verses 31 and 32 told us about this journey of Terach, and in verses 26 to 30 gave us this family history, I can't but assume that there's a connection between the journey and the family history. It must be. There's something what we just read in the trials and tribulations and the pain and the sorrow, the suffering of Terach and his family, that must somehow explain why the family went on this journey. There can't but be a connection between the things. Why else would the Torah write them, and why would they write them one after the other? So what we have to do now is try and understand what might be the connection, what might be the explanation in verses 26, 27, 28, 29, and 30 for the journey that's later described in verses 31 and 32. So, let's try and think, if we go back in time, go into the psyche of Terach and the family, what happens when children are not born for so many years? Well, in our generation, people go to doctors. They go to fertility clinics. They have lots of treatments. It's sometimes extremely expensive, extremely time-consuming, extremely painful, and extremely, extremely psychologically draining. Very often, together with the fertility clinics, people go to psychologists. They go to priests. They go to rabbis. They ask, well, why is this happening to me? How am I going to cope with the pain? They start examining their lives. In the time of Terach, we can assume that in addition to going to fertility clinics and to going to priests and to rabbis, they went to voodoo doctors, they went to idolatrous priests, they went whatever. They went to chiropractors, and they went to acupuncturists, and they went to palm readers, and they went to everything. They're looking for a solution, and it took a long, long, long time. If it worked or it didn't work, in the end they had children, but they were searching for the foundation, the reason of their pain and suffering and their lack, both on the physical level and on the psychological, spiritual, religious level. And then, to add to all this, when one of those children that is finally born dies at such a young age, well, the whole thing begins again. Where did we go wrong? The psychologists and the priests and the rabbis, you ask yourself deep questions about your life. You start perhaps a process of introspection. Was there anything that I did wrong? Anything I can improve in my life? And then Sarai is barren, and the whole thing begins again. This is really a story of tragedy, and all of us probably know families that have seen tragedy after tragedy. It breaks up families, it destroys families, but those families, those individuals that have the fortitude to overcome their pain by building themselves, by being built by the tragedies, there are cases in which people come out strengthened from it. And we know in general that the greatest creators in human history are people who have suffered. We say in Hebrew, lefum tzara agra. In English, you say no pain, no gain. It's all about the fact that one is steeled by his test, one is built by his test. We sometimes have the power to go inside of us and search deep and to be built up by what we suffer through. Not everyone has the power. Sometimes the tragedies are just overwhelming, but if the tragedies are not overwhelming, and if we have the fortitude to become creative, spiritual searchers, very often what happens is stealing and uplifting and elevating and ennobling. And you know that the rabbis say that that's the purpose of suffering. That's God tests us. To be tested doesn't mean that God's looking to give us a mark. It means to build us, to be strengthened by our trials and tribulations. That's why, by the way, it says in the Talmud that in the place that a penitent stands, even the fully righteous cannot stand. The fully righteous person has always been righteous. He's where he is. He's never grown because he's always been there. But someone who's a penitent, who's sinned, has had suffering, has pain in his life, and has managed to build himself up from that, to use it as a springboard, can go actually much higher in creativity and spirituality than the person who was always good. And perhaps that's what's going on here. The family of Terach is tested, is steeled, is put in the crucible of suffering, and their journey is to be understood as a good, proper, ennobling reaction to their search.
So why bad things happen to good people?
I'm afraid to say that that's why bad things happen to good people, but I'm willing to say that that's something good that can happen out of bad things happening to good people.
That's your great article.
Yeah, I've written more than once about that. Leslie.
Well, I have a question. If you are applying psychological reasons as to why they left, they also left their one son who had their grandchildren.
Ah, right.
And wouldn't you think that maybe Abraham and Sarah would leave, but Terach and his wife, wouldn't they want to stay around the one child that has given them grandchildren?
Yeah, that's something powerful. So, thinking about that, it could be that if this journey has something to do with the search for answers, the search for meaning, the search for children for Avram and Sarai, that Nahor and his wife didn't want to come because they had what they needed. They were satisfied. They had children. They weren't looking for what Terach was looking for. They weren't looking for what Avram and Sarai was looking for. If Terach asked them to come, you know, I don't know. We don't know. But they didn't come, and perhaps because they just didn't need it. They weren't on the same spiritual journey. They didn't have the same suffering that Terach had and that Avram had. Avram and Sarah had.
But that's not what she's saying. Is how could they leave with what they were leaving behind?
Right. So thank you for pushing me back on track.
Thank you.
But let me say to that, and then Mimi, that if we take the direction of thought that I'm trying to go in, what we've come to with the issue you bring up is the conflict between family on the one hand and the spiritual search on the other hand.
Who's doing this spiritual searching? Is it
so, let me kind of finish the thought.
Okay.
If indeed Terach has been through so much and gone to so many advisors and doctors and priests, and still it turns out that his son, their son, is barren, Sarai and Abraham, and they're looking for answers, they haven't found what they're looking for, so they go off on a journey. Perhaps, and we have to just think, they're going to turn over a new leaf. The answers they've been given by the doctors and by the religious functionaries of their place of the time, those answers didn't help because Avram and Sarai are still barren. The family tragedy is repeating itself. And perhaps they think that there's something to be found in a new land, a new place. Change your place, change your fate, change your future. And if it is this type of spiritual search, which we'll still have to define, then just to go on to what Leslie was talking about, then what do I do when I feel at the age of 40 or 50 or 60, call it a midlife crisis, call it a search for spirituality, search to help my children find a new beginning? What do I do when it means I have to leave behind the other children? There's a conflict here between the development of spirituality, development of personality, together with helping one child, that's in conflict with the family's already settled and doing well where we are, and I have to make a decision. And we can't say always which the best decision is, but there are certainly people that have to decide to make a break with the family to search for what they really think is the meaning of their life.
Was it not yet customary for the brother to take his son, his deceased brother's wife? I mean, what happened to...
Ah, so this matter of adoption we see here, right? Because Haran died, he left Lot, and Lot is adopted by Abraham.
No, but she's asking about Haran's wife.
So I wasn't going to get into that, but the Haran's wife It says here in verse 29, Avram and Nahor took to themselves wives, the son, the name of Avram's wife being Sarai, that of Nahor's wife Milcah, the daughter of Haran. So I don't know about the wife, but it appears here that it's not just Lot is a son of a deceased father, but actually Milcah is a daughter of the deceased father, and she's adopted by being married by her uncle. Now, if we have here two children of Haran that are adopted by one by being adopted as a son, the other being adopted as a wife, that might indicate that the wife herself died, and not just the husband. But that's a whole other story here that I didn't want to get into.
What happened to Yiska?
Yiska might also be, say Chazal, a daughter of this deceased couple, who's adopted by Avraham by marrying. Yes, yes, yes.
Okay, what happened to Terah? He doesn't have a wife?
Her, Mrs. Terach's name is not mentioned.
Never. It doesn't ever say he had a wife. I mean, it could have been anybody.
He had children.
All these children don't have wives mentioned either.
Right. Yeah. It's, for better or for worse, it's not the Torah's way to mention the names of women unless they play an active role. That's the male perspective that this book is written in. Take it or leave it. Okay, so now let's go one step further.
Well, I always wanted to bring that up because maybe that's why they left. His wife is dead. And he didn't have anything else to hold him.
I see, but again, we don't have any basis to assume that because the women are, their names are never mentioned. Could be it. It might not be. So anyway, to go on for a second, why Canaan? In the frame of everything we're talking about, if there is some type of search for a new leaf, a new meaning, why Canaan? We understand a journey, a new place, a new environment. We have to look in the Torah and think if there's anything in the Torah that gives us a hint to a reason why someone would go from Mesopotamia or of the Chaldeans to the land of Canaan. And you want to think of something? Yeah.
Isn't that his family lineage? I mean, isn't that his...
No, it's not. There's no family in the land of Canaan. Not yet. Not yet. But the Torah tells us certain things about the land of Canaan generations later that perhaps are truths that were true even generations earlier. Let me just give you an example. In the book of Deuteronomy, look at chapter 11, as I have it in the roadmap here. Deuteronomy chapter 11, verse 12. Deuteronomy chapter 11, verse 12. If you have my translation, it's page 292. 292, chapter 11, verse 12 says, describing the land of Israel, chapter 11, verse 12, Deuteronomy. It is a land which the Lord your God looks after, which the Lord your God always keeps his eye from year's beginning to year's end. Perhaps it's a metaphor. Perhaps it's only true when the Jewish people entered the land. But you can also see it as a statement that there's something inherent about this land. It's the promised land, perhaps, to begin with. Let me give you another set of verses that I have in the roadmap also, Vayikra chapter 18. Leviticus chapter 18. Which, if you have the translation that I have, it's page 184. Chapter 18 of Vayikra, verses 24 to 25. Leviticus chapter 18, verses 24 to 25. Do not defile yourselves in any of those ways. It's talking about all the sexual perversions. For it is by such that the nations that I am casting out before you defile themselves. Thus the land became defiled, and I called it to account for its iniquity, and the land spewed out its inhabitants. The Torah has an approach, at least in the book of Leviticus, that this land has a certain moral sensitivity. And those nations, even non-Jewish nations, that don't keep certain basic moral premises, they are vomited out, they're spewed out by the land. It's a kind of metaphysical, spiritual idea, but it might be indicative of some type of concept that this land of Israel, is the Holy Land. It's the Promised Land. It's a different land. Can I prove that? I can't prove that. But again, we're looking for some type of straw, some type of reason, some type of hint, why Terach, out of nowhere, when he wants to change his life, when he's looking for a spiritual new beginning, when he sees some problematics with all the doctors and idolatry that he's been through and hasn't helped him, when he's looking for something new, he doesn't go to any place but the land of Canaan. Perhaps he's heard rumors, ideas, that land in some sense has some spiritual propensity. But there's something one step further, which I also have on the roadmap I gave you, Bereshit chapter 14. Bereshit chapter 14. Genesis chapter 14. If you have my translation, then it's page 21. Genesis chapter 14, verses 18 to 23. This is the story of Sodom. Sodom and Gomorrah were at war with four kings that came from another land. And Sodom and Gomorrah lost the battle, and the cities were taken captive. Much booty was taken, and the people themselves were taken away. Abraham, upon hearing this, is disturbed, among other reasons, because one of the people taken captive is Lot, his nephew, who was living in Sodom. Mm-hmm. Abram musters an army and goes to do battle against the kings that have taken the booty and taken the captives away. Mm-hmm. And he actually succeeds in defeating the armies and redeeming the captives, including Lot. When Abram comes back to what's left of the cities of Sodom, we read the following story. We'll read with the beginning of chapter 14, verse 17. When he, meaning Avram, returned from defeating Chadar la'Omer and the kings with him, the king of Sodom came out to meet him in the valley of Shaveh, which is the valley of the king. And King Melchizedek of Shalem brought out wine and bread. He was a priest of God Most High. He blessed him, saying, in other words, Melchizedek blessed Avram, saying, "Blessed be Avram of God Most High, Creator of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your foes into your hand." And Avram gave him a tenth of everything. Avram gave this priest, this Kohen, a tithe. Then the king of Sodom said to Avram, "Give me the persons, I'll take the people back, the captives that you redeemed, and take the possessions for yourself." But Avram said to the king of Sodom, "I swear to the Lord God Most High, Creator of heaven and earth, I will not take so much as a thread or a sandal strap of what is yours, so you shall not say, it is I who made Avram rich." Let's think a minute about what we just encountered. There's this man, his name is Melchizedek, which by the way, Hebrew means Melchizedek. It means my king, righteous. Right? He is the king of a place called Shalem, which by the way, later becomes Yerushalem. Mm-hmm. This is the Jerusalem. He's the king of Jerusalem. He's a priest of God Most High. The word for priest is Kohen. He's a priest of the God Most High. And he meets Avram and he blesses Avraham in the name of the God Most High, Creator of heaven and earth. He's a monotheist. He's someone who's ahead of his time. Perhaps the first monotheist is Melchizedek. And Avraham, in verse 22, swears by God's name, and he uses the same name for God that Avram learned from Melchizedek. Avram says, "I swear to the Lord Most High, Creator of heaven and earth." He's copying, imitating the words that he just heard from Melchizedek. In other words, we can see this Melchizedek as a teacher of Avram, as perhaps, like I said, the first monotheist. Now put everything together. Malki Tzedek is in the land of Israel. He has a new religion, has a new approach to life, understanding the nature and the unity of the cosmos. He's in the promised land, the land that later we will hear is the land that God has his eyes on. So put everything together. Terach, difficult life, trials, tribulations, suffering, doesn't get answers from the prevalent religion of his day, goes out on a journey to the land of Canaan. Why? Perhaps because he heard about Malki Tzedek. Perhaps because this is, in some rumors he's seen in some internet site, it's the land of God. Perhaps there are answers there. Perhaps I can turn over a new leaf. Perhaps I can turn to this God, this one God, and find some type of succor, some type of help for my issues. Can we be certain of everything we said? Of course we can't be certain. Is it plausible? I think it's plausible. Again, why is all this plausible? Because the Torah told us about the trials and pain and the suffering of the family of Terach. Then it told us about the journey of Terach. And then it told us that God told Avram to continue the journey of Terach. Well, let's think for a second. If Terach went on his journey to the land of Canaan just in order to buy a new house, then why would God have told Avram to continue that journey? If God told Avram to continue his father's journey, there must have been something good, something noble, something important, something spiritual in that journey. And we try, by putting all the verses together, to try to understand how the verses are hinting to us of some type of spiritual search to the journey of Terach. And it makes sense. Again, it's plausible, it's not proven, but it's plausible, it's possible, it fits into the verses. It adds as little extraneous material as possible. And we have a picture. Yes?
Well, I wanted to connect also this incident with Melchi Tzedek, where he blesses Avram in the name of El Elyon, mm-hmm. with the next passage in the text, where now we have God speaking to Avram, and Avram says, so tell me, you know, I mean, how is all this going to happen if I'm childless, and now
right.
we have
right.
the promise of a child eventually. So
you're saying it happens only after
made it, mm-hmm. we finally made it to Melchi Tzedek, who is Kohen of El Elyon, and gets blessed by him, and now we have the conversation between Abram and God, and God finally says that that he tells him that they have the conversation about having a child, and he says, no, it's going to be one of your own.
Yeah, so that's, you're saying that's like the pinnacle, this, when Abram meets
Malki Tzedek. It's like finally we see the results of the completion of the journey.
Okay, that's nice. I like that. So, if we put it all together, we simply have a new perspective and a new picture of who Abraham is. It turns out that Terach, in a certain sense, is the first Jew. He's the one that begins the search for God and the search for meaning, the search for monotheism. He picks up his life and turns it upside down. He leaves his father's house and his family and everything he's familiar with. He leaves perhaps his ancestral religion and searches for something new. Terach had great ideals, ideas and ideals. He was able to begin a change in his life, but he didn't go the full way. He started journeying towards Canaan. He made it to Haran and got bogged down there. There are many people in life that have a vision of a new possibility, and they have hopes, and they begin on that journey, and that's wonderful. But in many cases, we don't finish. We get bogged down by the little things of life. But it's a beginning. And Avram is then told by God to pick up where your father left off, not to rebel against his father, but the opposite is the case, to absorb those values and go the final mile, which is what Avram does. And then, like Jan said, he makes it to Malki Tzedek, which might be seen as the climax of the whole thing here. And I don't know, think in terms like of Theodor Herzl. He was the dreamer for the Promised Land. He never saw the fruition of his dream. It then developed for the next generation to continue the work that was begun by the forefathers. So perhaps we should look at things like that. That Terach and Avraham are a team, and not Avraham as rebelling against Terach and turning over completely a new leaf.
Or like Moses.
Like Moses didn't make it to the Promised Land, but those followers of his continued on where he left off. And now, we have very little time left. There's one more matter, which is the following. Do we have a conflict between what might be pshuto shel mikra, the simple meaning of the text, do we have a conflict between what we saw today and the midrashim? Because we began 50 minutes ago with the midrash that many of you have heard that sees Abraham in conflict with his father. So yes, we do. That midrash is in conflict, so it seems, with the simple meaning of the text as I tried to present it. What I want to do in the last 5 minutes is point out that there are traditions, there are ancient traditions, there are midrashim that go in the same direction of the things we just talked about for the past 50 minutes. Oh, I forgot to photostat them for you. Goodness gracious, look at that. I forgot to photostat it. So good we didn't leave too much time to get to it, so I have to read it to you. And give it to you next time if you'd like to see it. But what I'm going to do is read to you a midrash. But again, I forgot to photostat. A midrash that goes back thousands of years. It says on chapter 11, verse 27, which begins with the words, "These are the generations of Terach." It says as follows: "The Holy One, blessed be He, gave honor to Terach and accepted his repentance, despite the fact that at the outset he was an idolater." I won't read to you, I'll rather paraphrase the proof that the Midrash brings for the fact that Terach was an idolater who repented. The proof is that later on, it says in the book of Genesis that God tells Abraham, you will die at a ripe old age and you'll be gathered to your fathers. It's an expression to that, gathered to your fathers. The Midrash says, why would Abraham want to be gathered to his fathers if his father was an evil idolater? It must be his father was a penitent. So that's the proof. And then it goes on to say, not only was Terach a repentant idolater, but it goes on to say the following. I quote, "And there is even more to it than that. Terach decided on his own to choose the land of Israel even before any command." That's his greatness. That Terach chose the land of Israel even before any command. So at least you see one midrash, and there are more, one midrash that clearly points out that the progenitor, if that's the proper pronunciation of the word, the progenitor of the Jewish people and the teacher of Abraham was none other than his father Terach, so we can rightly perhaps call him the first Jew. Okay, I'll photoset the midrashim and I'll give them out next time so you can flick at them at home.
Thank you. That's good. That's good.